In these lectures, I want to explore, in a frankly speculative spirit, some questions about our attitudes toward future generations. I hope you'll excuse the speculative character of my remarks. The questions I want to consider are large and difficult to think about, but they're important and perhaps even urgent, and I don't believe they've received as much attention from philosophers as they deserve. With the notable exceptions of Burkean conservatives and the adherents of some religious traditions, as well, perhaps, as some of the researchers affiliated with the Oxford Martin School and similar institutions and organizations, most of us who live in contemporary liberal societies lack a rich set of evaluative resources for thinking about the human beings who will come after us. We don't have a highly developed set of ideas about the value of human continuity, or about the values we hope will be realized in the future, or about the values and norms that should inform our own activities insofar as they affect future generations or depend on the expectation that there will be future generations. People's hopes or fears about the fate of their own personal descendants, primarily their children and grandchildren, constitute a partial exception to this generalization, but even these hopes and fears are usually fairly vague and inchoate. They're often limited to a general desire that things will go well for their descendants and an anxiety that they won't. Beyond that, many people are vaguely uneasy about the impact of our way of life on future generations, and there are the familiar ritualized declarations by public officials about our responsibilities to those who come after us. These declarations are sometimes transparently opportunistic, but even when they're sincere, they rarely spell out the content of the alleged responsibilities in a clear and convincing way. To some extent, the poverty of our evaluative discourse about the human future is matched by the poverty of our discourse about the human past. It's not just that levels of historical literacy are low. Perhaps that's always been true. It's also that, in recent times, a number of intellectual tendencies have combined to erode our disposition to look back on our forebears with reverence or piety, or to see them as setting standards to which we're bound by ideals of loyalty or honor to adhere. Among these intellectual tendencies, I would include tendencies toward individualism and religious skepticism, as well as an increased appreciation of cultural diversity and a simultaneous discomfort about the moral ambiguity of national and ethnic affiliations. These tendencies have helped to undermine earlier conceptions of the normative significance of the past, and we have not yet developed another set of concepts and attitudes to replace those whose grip on us has loosened. There's an interesting contrast, I think, between the way we think about temporal periods other than our own and the way we think about regions of the earth other than our own. Globalization and global integration are among the great buzzwords of our age. It's a familiar fact that technological advances have facilitated dramatic increases in global travel and communication, and in so doing have made possible social and economic interaction across national borders on an unprecedented scale. This, in turn, has had far-reaching effects on the way that many people understand the social world and their own place in it. And it has created increasing pressure to develop transnational norms and institutions to structure and regulate global travel, communications, commerce, and finance. So we've seen a rapidly growing interest, both within the academy and outside it, in what might be called global normativity, in topics like cosmopolitanism, global justice, human rights, and international law. Yet even as we're becoming, so to speak, geographically more cosmopolitan, we've become temporally more parochial, more firmly rooted in our own time, less likely to see our relations to those who came before us and those who will come after us as governed by a rich set of values and deal about global or international integration, but very little about temporal or intergenerational integration. Our awareness of the multiple interconnections among people in different parts of the world continues to expand, but our sense of the connections among different human generations has become increasingly impoverished, as compared, say, with more traditional societies, which often had rich and vivid conceptions of the importance of ancestors and descendants and of the continuity of the generations. These changes have not taken place overnight. More than 70 years ago, T.S. Eliot described the emergence of what he regarded as a new kind of provincialism, what he called the provincialism not of space, but of time. Eliot was a cultural conservative, and his primary concern in speaking about the provincialism of time was with what he saw as his contemporaries' inadequate appreciation of the values and standards of the past. But it's possible to interpret the attitudes that elicited his concern as symptoms of the more general phenomenon that I'm calling our temporal parochialism, which includes our attitudes both toward the past and toward the future. It's interesting to speculate as to why our temporal parochialism should be increasing even as its geographical analog has been declining. The explanation may at first seem straightforward. As I've already noted, recent decades have seen dramatic increases in global travel, communications, and economic activity, and our growing cosmopolitanism has been largely a response to those facts. But there have, of course, been no comparable temporal developments, no increases in travel or communications or economic exchange across different temporal periods. Moreover, many of us no longer hold the traditional beliefs that in earlier times underwrote people's sense of the connections among the generations. We do not find credible the stories that made it possible for people to assign such significance to their relations with their ancestors and descendants, and to see the generations as being so closely bound together. So it's hardly surprising that we have become temporally more parochial, even as we have become geographically more cosmopolitan. These divergent tendencies may even have a common cause, inasmuch as both of them have been encouraged by the rise of modern science. On the one hand, science has helped to facilitate the rapidly growing connections among the people of the world that have fueled the tendency toward geographical cosmopolitanism. On the other hand, science has helped to undermine many of the myths and narratives that sustain the confidence of traditional societies in the bonds linking them to other generations. At the same time, there are other possible explanations of our divergent attitudes that are also worth considering. One of these involves changing beliefs about the metaphysics of time. Perhaps we have become presentists about time, whereas our predecessors were eternalists. Perhaps we believe that only present objects and times exist, whereas they believe that past and future objects and times are equally real. This might help to explain why we have become temporally more parochial, even as we have become geographically more cosmopolitan. Of course, such a change in our beliefs would itself require explanation, especially since, in the view of many, it's not a change that's supported by modern science. And one natural suggestion is that, if we're more sympathetic to presentism than were our predecessors, that's because we no longer hold the traditional beliefs that made them feel connected to their ancestors and descendants. But if that's correct, then rather than explaining our growing temporal parochialism, the putative change in our beliefs about the metaphysics of time would instead be explained by it. Another possible explanation appeals to changing conceptions of freedom. According to this hypothesis, the kind of freedom we have increasingly come to value in the modern age is the freedom to pursue our present aims and goals, and this makes us hostile to claims purportedly made on us by our ancestors and descendants, by the inhabitants of the past and the future, and by traditions we do not now endorse. But the present aim conception of freedom is compatible with the idea that the political institutions that secure our freedom should be global rather than national in scope. So although we have principled reasons for endorsing a form of temporal parochialism, those reasons do not count against geographical cosmopolitanism. Again, of course, there's room to wonder which of the factors cited here is really the explanans and which is the explanandum. Perhaps our growing temporal parochialism explains our attachment to the present aim conception of freedom rather than vice versa. Still, a shift in our understanding of freedom constitutes one possible explanatory factor. The final hypothesis I'll mention is political. As I've already said, our increasing geographical cosmopolitanism is not only a moral, but also a political and institutional development. People throughout the world share a global politics, an arena of discourse in which arguments are advanced and rebutted, competing interests confront one another, policies are debated, and actors are made aware of the effect of their actions on others and of the likely response of those others. To the extent that we're becoming geographically more cosmopolitan, Part of what this means is that the reach of global politics is expanding. It's becoming more comprehensive, more inclusive, and institutionally more sophisticated. Of course, these developments are complex and open to different interpretations. But on any interpretation, there's a clear contrast with the temporal case, because the plain fact is that there is no intertemporal politics at all, nor could there be. We do not and cannot participate in a shared politics with human beings of other eras, nor can the generations of the past and the future advocate for their own interests within our politics. This is not to say that one generation cannot influence the political life of subsequent generations. Such influence is pervasive and is the source of the familiar Jeffersonian objection to allowing the dead hand of the past to constrain those who are now alive. The point is rather that we cannot engage in mutual debate, deliberation, or contestation with generations that do not overlap with ours. In that sense, we cannot share a politics with them. They cannot intervene in our political debates and deliberations except insofar as we choose to speak on their behalf. Moreover, increasing inclusiveness with respect to our own temporal cohort may actually help to produce decreasing inclusiveness with respect to other cohorts, since non-contemporaries must compete with contemporaries for our limited store of time, attention, and resources. If that's correct, then it's hardly surprising that an increase in geographical cosmopolitanism should be accompanied by an increase in temporal parochialism. These explanations do not exclude one another, and I won't attempt to decide among them. Nor is the list of explanations I've mentioned exhaustive. Still, other explanations are possible, and I won't attempt to canvass them all. In rehearsing a few candidate explanations, moreover, I don't mean to exaggerate either of the contrasting attitudes they purport to explain. On the one hand, our cosmopolitanism, such as it is very much a work in progress. It has met and continues to meet with strong opposition of many different kinds. It's far from clear how politically and culturally robust it will prove to be in the long run. For the time being, at least, the power of national and communal identifications and the ferocity of national and communal conflicts make its prospects look uncertain at best. On the other hand, and this is a point of greater direct relevance to the main argument of these lectures, I think that many people are uneasy about our temporal parochialism. As evidence I would cite with respect to our attitudes toward the past, the enormous interest in genealogy and the tracing of one's personal ancestry. The extent of this interest suggests that many people have strong desires to establish a sense of connection with their ancestors and to situate themselves in relation to those who lived in earlier times. These are not the desires of people who are indifferent to the past. They're the desires of people who hunger for a history. With respect to our attitudes toward the future, there are also indications that our temporal parochialism is a source of anxiety. Consider, for example, the large and ever-growing body of apocalyptic and post-apocalyptic literature and film, the rapidly expanding catalog of novels and movies devoted to stories about the destruction of the earth, about catastrophic events like plagues, nuclear conflicts, or collisions with heavenly bodies, about the imminent extinction, actual extinction, or near extinction of human life, and about the dystopian aftermath of such events. It doesn't seem unreasonable to suggest that the imaginative power of these apocalyptic and dystopian fantasies is fueled by a pervasive fear that our planet is in serious trouble, that the fate of our descendants is uncertain, and that the future of our species is by no means assured. These are not the concerns of people to whom future generations mean nothing. They are the concerns of people who are fearful about the future of humanity. I interpret both these sets of phenomena, both the interest in genealogy and ancestry and the popularity of apocalyptic and post-apocalyptic literature and film, as manifestations of uneasiness which serve to confirm the absence of any confident or untroubled or normatively articulate understanding of our place in time or our relations to people living at other times. The same uneasiness helps to explain why it's not uncommon for issues of public policy that implicate our attitudes toward the past or the future, issues ranging from the teaching of history to the protection of the environment, to elicit passionate debate and generate intense controversy. All these things indicate that our temporal parochialism is only part of the story. It may be true that, as compared with more traditional and more religious societies, we have an evaluatively impoverished understanding of the connections among the generations. Our thinking about those connections is not informed by any very rich or determinate set of values. Yet we are hardly uninterested in our relations to our predecessors and successors, and the very poverty of our evaluative thought about our place in the chain of generations is experienced by many people as a problem. It's experienced as a condition of privation, as an evaluative infirmity that stands in need of a remedy. I've been speaking about our attitudes both toward our ancestors and toward our descendants, but my primary concern in these lectures is with our attitudes toward future generations in particular, and so I won't have anything further to say about our attitudes either toward our predecessors or toward the past more generally. Those topics are very rich, but they're topics for another day. Nor will I pursue any further the question of how to explain the contrast between our geographical cosmopolitanism and our temporal parochialism. The question is interesting, but nothing that I want to say here depends on it, and so I'll set it aside and we'll focus exclusively on questions about our attitudes toward future generations. One urgent matter of public concern that clearly implicates those attitudes is the topic of climate change. The dominant view among those who have seriously considered poses a grave threat to our planet and to human life in particular. And although experts disagree about exactly how costly it will be for us to take effective action to minimize or mitigate the impact of climate change, by most accounts, the costs are likely to be significant. Suppose that is so, and suppose that failure to take such action will allow processes to unfold that will have drastic and potentially devastating effects on the lives of those who come after us. Some of the effects of climate change are already apparent, and in the absence of concerted action, more dramatic effects will be felt during our lifetimes. But the effects on people who come after us will be more devastating still. And eventually, the Earth may become uninhabitable by humans. Indeed, on the day that I wrote these words, the New York Times cited unnamed scientists as saying the Earth could become uninhabitable by the end of this century. If that's right, then we're faced with a choice. We must decide what costs we're willing to bear and how far we're willing to alter our lives in order to arrest or minimize processes that will otherwise create miserable conditions of life for many future inhabitants of this planet and may eventually lead to human extinction. The precise character of the choice will differ for people in different societies. The most affluent societies have historically been responsible for most of the greenhouse gas emissions that are the primary human cause of climate change, and those of us who live in such societies may have to decide how sharply we're willing to reduce our standard of living. By contrast, those who live in less developed societies that hope to achieve affluence as great as ours may instead have to decide to what extent they're willing to forego or delay the gains to which they aspire. But these choices have a common structure. In both affluent and developing societies, decisions must be made about the extent to which those now living are prepared to incur costs and to accept certain forms of hardship so that those who live later don't have to endure much greater hardships and so that human beings can continue to inhabit the Earth. Climate change has attracted the attention of researchers in many different disciplines. Philosophers in particular have been especially interested in the issues of justice and responsibility that it raises. How does justice require the costs of preventing or mitigating the worst effects of climate change to be shared among the nations of the world, which differ widely in their wealth, population, developmental level, and historical levels of greenhouse gas emissions? To what extent can the problem of climate change be addressed through the existing system of nation states and international organizations? And to what extent does the need to confront this problem call for the development of new structures of global governance? What would those structures have to look like in order to satisfy the demands of justice? And what are the responsibilities of individuals to modify their own behavior and to mobilize politically in support of efforts to combat climate change? These are all important questions. But there are some prior questions that also need to be addressed. Most fundamentally, there's the question of why we should care about climate change at all. In particular, why should we care about the effects of climate change that will not unfold until after we're gone? As I've said, the effects of climate change are already being felt, and in the absence of concerted action, and perhaps even with it, they're likely to become steadily more pronounced throughout the remainder of our lives. Most people would agree that we have reasons to be concerned about any effects of climate change that will have a significant impact on our own lives. And in practice, it's the severity of these effects that probably has the best chance of motivating us to do something about the problem. But suppose that even if climate change were to proceed unchecked, most of us could live out the remainder of our lives without any significant hardship ensuing. If this were true, would we still have reason to be concerned about those effects of climate change that will be felt only after we're gone and will affect only future generations? And if so, why exactly? In attempting to answer these questions, I think it's important to take seriously the idea that what we're discussing is the fate of future generations. Philosophers sometimes use the phrase future generations interchangeably with the phrase future people. And in some contexts, that bit of usage is perfectly innocent. But the word generations has distinctive content, and the widespread use of the phrase future generations is significant. It testifies to the fact that the people of the future, the people whose existence and flourishing are in question, do not present themselves to us in thought simply as an unstructured group. They present themselves to us as temporally and causally ordered. What is in question is the future of a chronological succession of generations, each produced causally in the familiar way by the one preceding it. When we ask why we should care about future generations, we're not simply asking why we should care whether people exist in the future or how those people fare. We're asking why we should care that the chronological succession of generations, which has delivered each of us here, should extend into the future under more rather than less favorable conditions. The difference between these questions is important. If we ask why we should care about future people, for example, or what our responsibilities toward them are, we may be tempted to suppose that the only thing that's at issue is the weight we should give to their interests or their welfare. We may fail to consider the possibility that the importance to us of future generations lies partly in the fact that they are our successors, that their existence extends the chain of generations in which we ourselves are participants. So just by the way we've framed the question, we may have diverted attention away from an important part of the answer. Yet if that is part of the answer, it's hiding in plain sight, its presence revealed whenever we use the phrase future generations. But who exactly is included within the scope of that phrase? On one interpretation, which we can call the unrestricted interpretation, future generations include all those people who are not yet alive but will be someday. So they include many people who will be born during our own lifetimes. Indeed, since it's been estimated that 267 people are born throughout the world each minute, it now includes thousands of people who will be born by the time I finish delivering this lecture, and who will then no longer fall within the scope of the phrase future generations. On a second interpretation, which we can call the restricted interpretation, the phrase refers only to those people who will not be born until everyone now living is dead. On this interpretation, the future people who will be born during the remainder of this lecture do not belong, even now, to future generations. Of course, both interpretations include indexical elements like now and not yet. So on either interpretation, the class of future people is constantly changing as the reference of those terms changes. And this reminds us that the idea of a succession of future generations oversimplifies a more complex reality. New generations of human beings do not appear all at once and replace previous generations all at once. Instead, as Brian Barry said, generations are an abstraction from a continuous process of population replacement. There are really two different points here. The first is that human parents do not in general cease to exist when their children are born, so that at any given time, the human population includes the members of different generations. The second point is that chains of human generations are constituted ultimately at the level of individuals and their ancestors and descendants, and these chains of individual descent do not follow a uniform timetable. So the lives of different people who are taken to belong to the same generation usually overlap temporally rather than completely coinciding. As I'll later emphasize, we shouldn't conclude from these points that the significance of the idea of future generations is to be given a purely reductionist understanding. We should not suppose, in other words, that any concern we have for future generations must really be a concern for some particular line of individual descent, such as, for instance, our own. Surprisingly, perhaps, future generations can themselves be objects of concern, despite the respects in which they are an abstraction. This is just to say that it can matter to us that human beings as a group continue to have descendants, whether or not we as individuals do. But here I'm getting ahead of myself. I'll return to this point in tomorrow's lecture when I'll offer my own account of the reasons future generations do and should matter to us. A point of more immediate concern is that the distinction between the restricted and unrestricted interpretations has implications for how we understand the question I've posed. The question of why we should care about the effects of climate change on future generations comes into sharpest focus if we give that phrase the restricted rather than the unrestricted interpretation. If we gave it the unrestricted interpretation, then some of the people we would be asking about in asking why we should care about the effects of climate change on future generations would be people whom we may eventually meet and with whom we may eventually come to have personal relationships that matter to us. So any adequate answer to the question of why we should care prospectively about the fate of future generations in the unrestricted sense would have to take into account and would surely be influenced by the fact that we may eventually establish actual relationships with some individuals who belong to those generations. But what I want to ask is why we should care about people that nobody now alive will ever meet and who will therefore remain forever outside the boundaries of our collective experience. Why should we be prepared to bear any costs at all for the sake of these strangers, whose identities are unknown to us and with whom we will never be acquainted? We will be gone forever by the time they arrive on the scene. Why should their fate be a source of concern for us now? Why should we be prepared to compromise the quality of our own lives in any way in order to improve or to avoid worsening the quality of theirs? More radically, why should we be troubled even if, as a result of climate change, life on Earth becomes completely impossible in the future, so that the chain of future generations simply runs out? If these are the questions we wish to ask, then we'll want to give the phrase future generations the restricted rather than the unrestricted interpretation. We should not suppose that only a moral skeptic would think to raise these questions. For anyone who is tempted to think of morality in broadly relational terms, that is, as a set of values and norms that govern our relationships with one another, it may seem genuinely unclear what morality has to say about the implications of our actions for those people with whom neither we nor anyone else now living will ever have a personal relationship of any kind. Surely it must have some things to say. According to any plausible relational view, for example, it would surely be wrong to deploy a nuclear bomb that was timed to detonate in a major population center in 200 years, killing many people who do not now exist. Still, on a relational conception of morality, it remains unclear how much guidance the moral norms that govern our relations to our contemporaries provide when we're thinking about the implications of our actions for people with whom nobody now alive will ever have a personal relationship. So even when the point of raising the questions I've mentioned is to explore our specifically moral responsibilities with respect to future generations, those questions need not be expressions of general moral skepticism. They may instead reflect genuine puzzlement about the ways in which the reach of morality extends into the future. At the same time, it should be noted that the questions as I frame them make no reference to morality in particular. They're questions about our reasons for caring what happens to future generations. They do not presuppose that any reasons we have must be moral reasons, nor is that an assumption we should make in thinking about possible answers to those questions. If we have reasons to care about future generations, those reasons may or may not be found within the realm of morality. What is true is that any answer to the question of why we should care about the effects of climate change on future generations, or about the threat it poses of eventual human extinction, must draw on ideas of value of the kind I began by discussing. It must draw on some conception of the value or importance of human continuity and survival. If what I've said is right, most of us have no settled and well-developed conception of this kind. We exhibit a kind of temporal parochialism, but we're not secure in our parochialism. To some extent, at least, we seem preoccupied with our place in the chain of generations despite ourselves. And our very ambivalence evidences a tacit recognition that the fate of our successors implicates values that are important to us, or so it seems to me. My aim in these lectures is, in effect, to excavate the sources of our ambivalence. Ultimately, I want to suggest we have richer evaluative resources than we may realize for thinking about the future of humanity. And we have stronger and more varied reasons than we commonly acknowledge for caring about the fate of our successors. If this is correct, then we gain in self-understanding when we come to appreciate these resources and these reasons. We gain in our understanding of the kind of creatures we are and of the things that really matter to us. But there may be practical gains to be had as well. If it's true that we have richer evaluative resources than we realize for thinking about the future of humanity, then these are resources that may be mobilized to address those contemporary conditions, including but not limited to climate change, that pose such serious threats to future generations. Despite the unsettled state of our evaluative thought about the future, questions about our responsibilities to future generations have been the subject of a large philosophical literature that has grown up over the past several decades. One of the earliest and most important contemporary contributions to that literature was made by John Rawls, whose theory of justice includes what he called a just savings principle that governs the distribution of resources among different generations. The just savings principle has some attractive features, but Rawls's discussion of it is relatively brief and undeveloped as compared with other elements of his theory, and his account of the principle's basis changed significantly over time. Much of the subsequent philosophical literature about future generations has developed not in response to Rawls, but rather in response to the brilliant and pioneering work of Derek Parfit in Part 4 of Reasons and Persons. Parfit's work, and much of the literature responding to it, is of broadly utilitarian orientation. One of its primary aims is to formulate what Parfit calls a principle of beneficence that seems credible when applied to questions about how the well-being of future people should be taken into account in our decisions about how to act now. Beneficence, as Parfit understands it, is the part of morality that is concerned with well-being. And for utilitarians, this is the entirety of morality. But in Reasons and Persons, Parfit uses the term principle of beneficence instead of principle of utility to refer to this part of morality. He does this because, whereas utilitarians think that a principle concerned with well-being comprises the whole of morality, some non-utilitarians accept such a principle as just one element of their wider moral outlook, which may also include, for example, a commitment to individual rights. The term principle of beneficence, then, is Parfit's label for the principle concerning well-being, which, in some version, utilitarians take to comprise the whole of morality, and which some non-utilitarians instead take to comprise just one element of morality. An adequate principle of beneficence, it is hoped, would enable us to determine how, when assessing actions and policies that will affect future generations, we should balance considerations about the number of people who will come to exist against considerations about the quality of life that those who come to exist will enjoy. And it would help to resolve puzzles arising from the fact that our actions may affect the identities of those who will come to exist. These questions and puzzles, and others like them, are taken to define the field of population ethics. Utilitarian considerations have long played a prominent role in the discussion of our responsibilities to future generations, because the basic logic of utilitarianism, with its imperative to maximize the good and its identification of the good with happiness or welfare or well-being, makes questions about the status of future generations as objects of moral concern seem immediately salient. If our concern is to maximize welfare, then the welfare of future people would appear offhand to be just as relevant as the welfare of the living. And in addition to making the questions salient, of course, utilitarianism also proposes answers to them. Each of the most familiar versions of the theory seems to have clear implications for questions about our responsibilities toward future generations. Up to a point, this reflects one of the great historical strengths of the utilitarian tradition. Because of their single-minded focus on what will enhance welfare or well-being, utilitarians have never been willing to take for granted the moral significance of distinctions that have the effect of restricting the scope of welfarist concern, no matter how morally fundamental those distinctions may previously have been taken to be. They have refused to assume, for instance, that the suffering of non-human animals counts for less than the suffering of humans, or that the suffering of people in distant lands matters less than the suffering of our compatriots, or similarly, that the welfare of future people counts for less than the welfare of our contemporaries. In consequence, utilitarians have been among the first to insist on the importance of questions about the ethical treatment of animals, about the obligations of affluent individuals and societies to help alleviate global poverty, and of course, about our responsibilities toward future generations. In raising and pressing such questions, utilitarians have exerted pressure to widen the scope of moral concern. Since utilitarians and non-utilitarians alike regard the tendency toward greater inclusiveness as one of the most important achievements of modern moral thought, the inclusive pressure exerted by utilitarian ideas speaks to non-utilitarians as well. So whatever they think of the utilitarians' answers to questions about the ethical treatment of animals or global poverty or future generations, non-utilitarians rarely deny the significance of the questions. On the whole, moreover, non-utilitarians have been slower to develop alternative answers of their own to those questions, especially to questions about our responsibilities to future generations. In part, that may be because, as Parfit suggests, some non-utilitarians accept a general principle of beneficence as one part of their moral outlook, and because they agree with utilitarians that beneficence is the ultimate source of our responsibilities to future generations. But it's also because most non-utilitarian outlooks lack the simple structure that, in theory at least, allows utilitarianism to be applied straightforwardly to virtually any first-order moral question. And insofar as non-utilitarian outlooks include elements other than a principle of beneficence, the possible bearing of those other elements on questions about our responsibilities to future generations is often far from transparent. As I've noted, for example, many non-utilitarians tend to think of morality as a whole in broadly relational terms. They think of it as comprising a set of values and norms that govern our relationships with one another. And whether or not one accepts a relational view of morality as a whole, it's clear that many non-utilitarian ideas seem at home primarily in the context of personal or communal relationships or cooperative arrangements. Thick relationships of these kinds supply many of the contexts in which we deploy familiar deontic concepts with greatest confidence, and we don't have such relationships with the members of future generations. There are, of course, relational principles that are meant to apply to our treatment of other people independently of any thick relationships we personally may have with those people. However, as I've said, the bearing of such principles on questions about future generations is not always obvious. Even if we accept that all people should be treated with respect, for example, it may not be altogether clear what is involved in treating people who do not yet exist with respect. But surely what we do can affect the quality of life that future people enjoy. So insofar as we have obligations toward these people, it's tempting to think, in a broadly utilitarian spirit, that the content of those obligations is fixed by norms specifying how we should take the well-being of future people into account when deciding how to act and what policies to adopt. And it's tempting to think this even if one does not accept a more general principle of beneficence of the kind that Parfit has in mind. Yet despite the prominence of utilitarian ideas in the literature on future generations, I myself do not find it helpful to think about the subject in utilitarian terms. I will not pursue the quest for a principle of beneficence that can guide our conduct with respect to future generations, nor will I frame my discussion with reference to the questions of population ethics. One reason for this is evident from what I said at the beginning of this lecture. I'm interested in the broad topic of how future generations feature in or are related to our practical and evaluative thought as a whole. I'm concerned with questions about what hopes we may have for our successors, about whether and why their survival and flourishing matter to us, and about what reasons we may have for concerning ourselves with their fates. From this perspective, questions about our moral duties or obligations toward them, whether we conceive of such duties in utilitarian or non-utilitarian terms, constitute only a subset of the questions that are worth considering. Values of many different kinds may have roles to play in our reflections about future generations, and they need not all take the form of moral obligations. Moreover, there are costs to a narrow and highly moralized focus on questions of duty and obligation. Such a focus may discourage us from thinking broadly about the kinds of meaning and value that we attach to the continuation of human life on Earth. It may tempt us to suppose, wrongly in my opinion, that future generations matter to us only insofar as they add to our already abundant stock of potentially burdensome obligations. In so doing, it may contribute to the well-known problem of obligation fatigue, while blinding us to some of the most important ways in which our values orient us toward the future, or would do if we paid attention to them. Even within the territory of moral duty or obligation, an exclusive emphasis on beneficence-based duty seems to me a mistake. As I said a moment ago, it's a strength of utilitarianism that, by virtue of its single-minded emphasis on maximizing welfare or well-being, it exerts pressure to widen the scope of moral concern to include groups that have often been excluded: non-human animals, distant strangers, future people. Yet its strength is also its weakness. The same focus on maximizing welfare that leads utilitarians to raise important questions about the ethical treatment of previously excluded groups also leads them, at times, to give very implausible answers to those questions. So, for example, although the most familiar versions of the principle of utility appear to have clear implications for questions of population ethics, those implications strike most people as being manifestly unacceptable. Consider, for example, the classical or total version of utilitarianism, which directs us to maximize the total aggregate welfare of all human beings, or perhaps all sentient creatures. This seems to entail that we're morally required to keep increasing the size of the human population so long as each new person added yields a net increase in the total aggregate welfare of humanity, even if the average level of welfare per person falls significantly. Or consider instead average utilitarianism, which directs us to maximize average rather than total welfare. According to this version of the view, the size of the population at a given time doesn't matter in itself, so long as it comprises the population, the people who, on average, enjoy the highest attainable levels of well-being. So the imperative might be to cultivate and maintain a relatively small population of people to whom happiness comes easily and who are robustly disposed to contentment. Neither of these positions strikes most people as being at all credible. In fact, Parfit himself insists on the implausibility of the answers given by both the total and the average versions of utilitarianism, and most of the beneficence-based literature is preoccupied with trying to resolve the puzzles that arise when one seeks to formulate a credible alternative to the total and average views. The aim is to find a principle of beneficence that does not have what are acknowledged to be absurd or repugnant or ridiculous or otherwise unacceptable implications when applied to questions of population ethics. Yet despite the fact that the quest for a suitable principle of beneficence has for decades featured prominently in the philosophical literature dealing with our responsibilities toward future generations, no plausible principle of this kind has yet been identified. How one interprets the significance of this fact will depend on one's wider moral outlook. For utilitarians, beneficence is the whole of morality, and so for them, an adequate principle of beneficence would give a complete answer to the apparently more general question of what responsibilities we have toward future generations. And without an adequate principle of beneficence, not only are our responsibilities toward future generations left uncertain, but the entire content of morality is called into question. This makes the quest for such a principle, for what Parfit calls theory X, a matter of the utmost importance. But for non-utilitarians, beneficence is at most one aspect of morality, and it's not clear that we need, even as one element of morality among others, an extremely general principle of beneficence of the kind that utilitarians want, a principle modeled on the principles of total and average utility, but modified to avoid their unwelcome implications. Nor is it clear to non-utilitarians that we should expect all the questions of population ethics to have answers. Parfit says in Reasons and Persons that theory X, the better account of beneficence that he's seeking, quote, would have acceptable implications when applied to all of the choices that we ever make, including those that affect both the identities and the number of future people. Indeed, he goes further and says that, quote, in a complete moral theory, we cannot avoid the question of how many people there should ever be, which is not a question about any of our choices at all. However, non-utilitarians may not share the conceptions of moral theory and of completeness that make this last question seem to Parfit unavoidable, and some of them may not even be confident that they understand the question. Nor are non-utilitarians bound to agree that we should expect to find a principle of beneficence that will have acceptable implications when applied to all the choices human beings ever make. The idea that non-utilitarians can make do without a general principle of beneficence of the kind that utilitarians seek may seem plainly mistaken. Parfit says that many people accept a theory that includes both a general principle of beneficence and a set of rights that are taken to constrain beneficence. Some would go further and argue that any minimally credible non-utilitarian outlook must include such a principle. After all, ideas of beneficence and related ideas of charity, liberality, and humanity have a long history in moral thought, much longer than the history of utilitarianism itself. Moreover, many non-utilitarians have reasons of their own for distinguishing between justice and beneficence and for treating each of them as defining an important part of the content of morality. But although these points are surely correct, it's also true that beneficence and related ideas have historically been understood in many different ways, as has the distinction between beneficence and justice. In our day, non-utilitarians frequently acknowledge duties of humanitarianism that are sometimes taken to fall under the heading of beneficence rather than justice, but these duties are typically treated as defining a kind of moral minimum. They spell out our responsibilities to assist strangers in emergencies or in circumstances of extreme deprivation or suffering. When utilitarians speak of a principle of beneficence, by contrast, they have in mind a kind of generalized imperative to do good, a principle modeled on the principles of total and average utility themselves. And although there may be some non-utilitarians who accept, as one element of their view among others, a principle of beneficence so understood, it's not true, I think, that most of them do. Nor do I know of any argument capable of establishing that all non-utilitarians need to accept such a principle, except for arguments that beg the question by presupposing the truth of utilitarianism or something like it. I've been explaining why I don't find it helpful to think about the issue of future generations in utilitarian or beneficence-based terms. Doing so, I've said, narrows the focus of reflection to questions of moral duty and responsibility, whereas I'm interested in the broader topic of how future generations feature in or are related to our practical and evaluative thought as a whole. And even where moral duty and responsibility are concerned, I believe it's a mistake to concentrate exclusively or primarily on beneficence-based duties, both because no plausible account of those duties is available, and because unless one is a utilitarian, it's not obvious that we need or should expect to find such an account. So insofar as we wish to engage in moral reflection about the future, we have good reasons not to limit our reflections to the questions of population ethics or the search for a satisfactory principle of beneficence. There's another reason to avoid framing questions about future generations in exclusively utilitarian or beneficence-based terms, for such an approach is limiting in a way that goes beyond those already noted. It asks how we should take the interests of future people into account in our decisions and actions, and it attempts to answer that question by identifying a suitable principle of beneficence to guide us. In so doing, it frames the issues from the outset as ones pertaining exclusively to the interests or the welfare or the well-being of future generations. This neglects the point I made earlier about the significance of the word generations. It neglects the possibility that part of what is important to us about future generations is precisely the fact that they are generations, that they are participants, as we are, in the same chain of human succession. As I'll explain more fully tomorrow, I believe that this point is significant, whether its significance is understood as moral, in moral or non-moral terms, and that it's a mistake to overlook it. Finally, there's a practical difficulty with a purely utilitarian approach, at least insofar as one thinks it would be desirable for people to take more seriously problems like climate change and nuclear proliferation, which pose such grave threats to the lives and circumstances of our descendants. From a utilitarian perspective, the ethical significance of future generations lies, roughly speaking, in their status as potential victims or beneficiaries of what we do. But unlike other potential victims and beneficiaries, future generations don't actually exist yet. And this obvious fact poses a serious difficulty from a utilitarian perspective because many utilitarians appeal to sympathy as the primary motive that's supposed to lead people to comply with utilitarian norms. If we ask how people might come to be stably motivated to maximize the well-being of all human beings or all sentient creatures, the most common answer within the utilitarian tradition appeals to our capacity for sympathetic identification with others. Many non-utilitarians are skeptical about whether sympathy is in general a sufficiently robust and reliable feature of human psychology to provide a secure basis for moral motivation. Whether or not one shares those general doubts, however, all sides are agreed that motives like sympathy are most effective in motivating action when we're confronted in a vivid and immediate way with the plight of people who are suffering. In the aftermath of a natural disaster, for example, televised images of people suffering often elicit an outpouring of assistance, whereas more abstract descriptions of human need generate less of a response. But vividness and immediacy are precisely what are lacking when we contemplate the lives of future generations. So whatever one thinks of the motivational credentials of utilitarianism in general, there are specific reasons for pessimism about the capacity of utilitarian reasoning to motivate strong action in behalf of our descendants. This point is especially significant in view of the fact, mentioned earlier, that there's no possibility of a genuinely intertemporal politics in which future generations can represent themselves and defend their own interests. Despite this obvious fact, any concerted effort to address the problems that threaten future generations will require a politics of some kind, and there's a real question whether the motives that might drive such a politics exist and are sufficiently prevalent and powerful among the living to be efficacious. If such a politics can rely on no motive more powerful than sympathy sustained by the hortatory force of utilitarian moral argument, then I think its prospects are bleak. This gives us practical as well as theoretical reasons for not wanting to restrict ourselves to utilitarian ideas. In saying this, I don't mean to be offering a utilitarian argument for encouraging non-utilitarian motives. My point is rather that, in light of the doubts I've been rehearsing about the motivational efficacy of sympathy, we have additional reasons for not wanting to limit ourselves in advance to a utilitarian approach to problems of future generations. If we find alternative approaches that are intellectually more compelling, they may also prove to be practically more effective. I began this lecture by contrasting our increasing temporal parochialism with our increasing geographical cosmopolitanism, and by noting that our temporal parochialism is a source of uneasiness. Given this uneasiness, one apparent advantage of utilitarianism is that it treats spatial and temporal distance in the same way. The utilitarian principle provides a unified standard that's meant to govern our treatment of people both in other places and at other times. If, for the reasons I've given, we don't endorse the utilitarian approach, one obvious alternative is to look for a non-utilitarian principle of justice that provides some other unified standard of the same kind. Perhaps, for example, we can settle on some version of a currently popular philosophical theory like luck egalitarianism or prioritarianism or Rawls's difference principle to fix the content of justice both globally and intertemporally. But I will not take this approach either. There are at least three different reasons for this. First, such an approach would narrow and moralize the discussion of future generations in the same way that the beneficence-based literature does. And the considerations that count against narrowing our reflection in this way apply with equal force to the search for non-utilitarian principles of intertemporal justice. Second, in calling attention to the growing asymmetry in our evaluative attitudes towards spatial and temporal distance, I was describing a feature not of philosophical theories of justice, but rather of the evaluative thought of our culture more generally. Even if a philosophical theory treats space and time symmetrically, it cannot eliminate this broader cultural tendency by fiat, and it's the broader tendency that I want to explore. Third, in highlighting the growing asymmetry in our attitudes, I do not mean to suggest that complete symmetry is to be expected, only that these divergent trends call for some explanation, and that whatever the explanation may be, our temporal parochialism reflects a certain impoverishment in our evaluative thought about generations past and future. In these lectures, I want to investigate the limits of our parochialism and to see whether there may be, implicit in our evaluative thought, ideas that bear in insufficiently recognized ways on our reasons for concerning ourselves with the fate of future generations. If so, then perhaps those ideas may eventually help us to identify compelling principles of justice that apply to the intergenerational case. Whether those principles would apply equally to the case of global justice cannot be known in advance. In the meantime, however, my goal will not be to develop a non-utilitarian principle of intertemporal distributive justice, but rather to explore some of the pertinent evaluative commitments that I believe to be latent in our existing attitudes. I hope that the investigation of these commitments will help to enrich our understanding of the significance that future generations have for us. To anticipate, I don't think it's true, as utilitarianism encourages us to think, that future generations are nothing more to us than potential beneficiaries or victims of our actions. Even if we no longer accept the traditional narratives that once underwrote people's sense of the continuity among the generations, we remain more invested in the fate of our descendants, and they remain more thoroughly implicated in the structures of value that we rely on in our own lives than we normally recognize. If that's right, then we may have richer evaluative resources available for thinking about our relations to them than we normally realize. In tomorrow's lecture, I'll develop the suggestion further. I won't investigate the nature or extent of any reasons of beneficence we may have for concerning ourselves with the fate of our successors. Instead, I will argue that quite apart from considerations of beneficence, we have reasons of at least four different kinds for trying to ensure the survival and flourishing of those who come after us. Reasons of love, reasons of interest, reasons of value, and reasons of reciprocity. Admittedly, my arguments, even if successful, will not provide us with a fully articulated conception of the values that inform our relations to future generations. But by enriching our understanding of the variety of reasons we already have for caring about their existence and what happens to them, I hope that these arguments will lay the groundwork for further reflection about how we may sensibly conduct ourselves when the fate of our successors is at stake. Even the question of whether there can be a politics of future generations may look different and may merit additional reflection once a more complete picture of the normative and motivational resources available to such a politics is in hand. Thanks.